and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis.
Hello, pod pals. I'm going to keep today's intro brief because this interview is packed to the rafters with juicy content, and we might as well get straight down to it. This week, I spoke to Rowan Woods, who has jammed so much into her career, it's actually pretty staggering, and is also possibly one of the loveliest people I've ever met. As you'll hear towards the end, she actually brought chocolates to the recording. Hint, hint, for future guests. Rowan is currently the film programme manager for the British Council, where she finds and screens new UK features to international film festival selectors, as well as being the industry programmer for this year's London Film Festival. Previously, she was a development executive at BBC Films, so we chat about working her way up to that role, taking strategic career leaps, staying healthy at film festivals, and being a friend to young women in the industry. It's no surprise that several people have requested that Rowan be a guest on the podcast, so I'm very happy to finally be making that happen. This is episode 27 of Best Girl Grip.
University of Manchester, and I did English and American Literature, and that would have been, gosh, when was that? 2004 to 2007, and then I did go back about 5 years later to do a master's. Actually, not at the University of Manchester. I did that at the University of Sussex, and in fact, I kept applying to do a master's every single year after I graduated, and then some kind of exciting work opportunity would come up, so I'd always put it off.
And what was the master's in?
In film studies, because I'd done English, and I have to say, I found my English degree quite tedious, certainly the first year. And so, because I was also studying American literature, there were quite a few film modules that you could do as part of that. So actually, I angled my degree towards film, and I did my dissertation on film and quite a few modules on film. So I'd always felt like that was the thing that I really wanted to be doing.
Mm. And were you following a passion in studying the master's, or did you kind of think there might be a career at the end of this?
Absolutely passion. In fact, quite a few people said to me that it was probably a bad idea to leave the industry, because by that point I'd been working for about 5 years, and I was working at the BBC, and I was working as a researcher and a producer on quite big film programmes.
Okay.
I had really good contacts. I was properly in the industry. So actually leaving the industry for a year or 2 years to do a master's was actually quite a potentially a foolish thing to do.
Yeah.
So I was absolutely doing it out of passion. And it's that thing, you know, I think a lot of people can get after a couple of years after graduating. You know, you finish your degree and you are sort of mentally at your kind of highest pitch. And a couple of years later, I was like, God, I just feel really stupid. I felt, you know, I don't feel as sort of mentally agile. And I just really missed studying and thinking about film in that way. And actually, in the end, I ended up doing the master's part-time whilst living in London, whilst working still on a BBC film programme. And that wasn't the intention. I actually left the BBC thinking, right, I'm finally going to go and do this master's.
Mm.
I was just incredibly lucky. I bumped into someone on a tube and they offered me a job. And it was incredibly, incredibly lucky.
And did you feel like it elevated your career? Did you go then into a different path?
No, not really. What it did do, and in fact, now that I think about it, the thing that I really wanted to get out of it was confidence. And confidence in my intellectual ability and in my written ability. I think because that's the thing that I was missing. For a long time, I'd felt like I wanted to be a film journalist. And that's something that I don't quite know where that came from, but I have a really distinct memory of, on my gap year, telling someone, they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I want to be a film critic. And I have no idea where that came from.
I had that where I wanted to be a film critic, and I think it's because I saw films and then I saw people reviewing them, and I literally thought those were the only two jobs.
Yeah,
that, like,
yeah.
You make the films or you write about the films.
Yeah, I'd always I grew up in quite a small village, and so didn't have that much access to. I mean, we had a cinema in Gloucester that you could go to, which showed There's Something About Mary in Titanic. But I got all of my proper sort of art house education from reading Peter Bradshaw and Philip French in The Guardian and in The Observer, and also reading all of the like capsule film listings in The Guardian Guide. Okay. So I knew who all of those critics were. You know, I knew who Steve Rose was and who Peter Bradshaw was. And I just sort of sucked up that knowledge and have always been quite drawn to, in quite a geeky way, to sort of building a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of a particular passion of mine. So one time that was music, and then it became film. So I think already by that point I had this sense that, you know, critics were kind of my rock stars, and I'd really sort of looked up to those. But for some reason, you know, even after getting a very good degree, and I knew I could write, and I was the film editor of my student newspaper, there was something about, you know, when I came to London, and maybe it was that I just, that there's sort of that film culture that you have now, where it's so easy to sort of, if you're confident enough and if you shout loud enough on Twitter, there is that community that you can quite easily infiltrate and be part of. That sort of didn't exist when I first moved to London.
Yeah.
And it sort of felt like quite a leap to get from where I was to where I wanted to be. And I think a lot of that leap was entirely self-imposed and was to do with my lack of confidence in myself. So I think a lot of going to do the Masters was about just building up my confidence in writing and in my knowledge. Because I also had that thing of, oh, well, I just don't know enough.
Yeah.
You know, I was working on film programmes at the BBC with Mark Kermode, and so I would look to him and be like, oh, well, you know, I can't possibly do that.
Yeah.
He's got 20 years on me and he's sort of the best at what he does. So, yeah, I think that was the motivation behind buying the Masters.
And did the researching role kind of open your eyes to another side of the industry?
As I say, I was the film editor of the newspaper at university. And through that led to quite a few other things. So through that, I did work experience at a film magazine that was called Hot Dog at the time. And it was you know, in the vein of kind of Empire and Total Film. And I also did work experience on, there was a short-lived film festival in Manchester called the Commonwealth Film Festival. So I did work experience on the press team. And then I also went to work for Corner House, which was Manchester's main kind of art house cinema. So I'd had a certain sense of sort of various jobs. And then when I first came to London, a couple of months after graduating, I went to work on the London Film Festival on the press team. So by that point, I had a very good sense of how the kind of press side of the industry worked, you know, because I'd been doing interviews and junkets and going to press screenings at university. Yeah. I think, and then I also got access to how a big event like that and a big organisation like that is put on. And I think it also instilled in me a really high, slightly fierce level of kind of professionalism and decorum. And, you know, when you're having to sort of run 3 red carpets a night and you have to have a kind of smiley, brave face on, at, you know, kind of day 12 of the festival. I think the only reason I ended up working at the BBC, in fact, is because when I was on the press team at LFF, I had some dealings with someone who worked, a woman who worked on the culture show at the BBC. And she, you know, had this, she was their film researcher. I didn't really know what that meant, but it sounded like incredibly fucking cool. And when I did the LFF for two years on the press team, and I worked in between that for a distributor, an independent distributor called Revolver, who sadly don't exist anymore. And by that point, having done PR for 2 years, I was quite certain that I didn't want to be a PR. I still wanted to be a journalist. Right. And I think partly I was just too earnest. I was too serious. And, you know, the idea of having to sell films that I didn't passionately believe in was just, I just couldn't do it. Yeah. I took myself very seriously. So I knew that there was this job, this kind of job that one could do. And pretty much the only TV show I watched was The Culture Show. So I just emailed their series producer. I saw on the credits who the series producer was, and I knew what the BBC like email format was, and I just emailed, and it's that probably that one email that had the sort of biggest impact on my career, and it was just one of those things of kind of right place, right time, you know, right tone.
Yeah. Presumably, you personalised it, being like, you know, I watched the Culture Show.
Oh, Nicole, I was super charming. Still don't know quite where that this sort of fit of inspiration came from. And then I went in and she was kind enough to reply to me and say, come in for a coffee. So I went in and had a coffee, and that sort of then led to another coffee with the editor on the programme. And they said they didn't have a job, but it was really nice to meet me and what have you. And then about a week later, they came back to me and said, well, we've got a job for you. When can you start? And it was incredible, just a real piece of sort of luck, serendipity. And it's, you know, it's very hard. So I went into the BBC at researcher level, which is quite a difficult thing to do. And I'd never worked in TV before, so there was quite a lot of technical stuff that I didn't know, you know, technical like production stuff that I didn't know. But what I did know was I had good relationships with the distributors and with the PR people, and that's what got me the job.
You say serendipitous, but you tailored yourself to that position, which is something that I don't think enough people do. They sort of walk up to people and say, I like film.
Yeah.
Can you help, kind of thing?
Yes, I suppose so. Well, certainly when you look in hindsight, and this is often the way, isn't it? When you look back on a career, you can go, oh, I've been so strategic. And of course, I sort of didn't. I didn't really know what I mean, maybe I did it somewhere, but I did have a very clear sense that I was probably a good candidate for that for that job, and certainly I've positioned myself in the right sort of way, and I said, look, I know these people and I can do this stuff. I was bold, and you know, that's something I often tell people is, you know, as you know, so jobs are so rarely advertised. And learning how to email people out of blue in a way that, you know, is, you know, with the right combination of sort of kind of charm and flattery, but also, you know, understanding of why you're emailing and sort of specificity is a really sort of useful thing to learn. Yeah.
And were you living in London and making a living solely off the job at that point?
So when I very first came to London for the London Film Festival, initially it was an unpaid 3-month internship at Premier PR, who was the agency who did the press for the festival. So luckily my boyfriend at the time, who was still in Manchester, his parents lived in London. So I was able to come down and stay with them. In the end, as it turned out, the festival ended up giving me a paid job. So actually, but even then, you know, not enough to sort of live on for that amount of time. And then when I was working for Revolver, for the distribution company, I was making 11 grand. And I could own, so I was living in Shepherd's Bush, beyond Shepherd's Bush, and I was working in Notting Hill, and I could only afford to get the bus one way each day.
Oh, so, how are we getting home?
Well, I had to walk.
Oh my goodness.
I was very slim. But yeah, so I was really, and we were living in this damp sort of basement flat, and it was miserable. And so then when I then got my job at the BBC, and I was earning, I don't know, 18 grand. It was super, I was super flash.
And from there, from the BBC, what was your next job?
So I was at the BBC for 9 years in total, okay. In some form or another. So I worked on the Culture Show for a year. Mm-hmm. I was then asked inadvertently, but it is absolutely advice I would give to anyone that was looking to have some kind of career in kind of arts journalism or working on arts programmes, is have a specialism. And I had a specialism, so I became known within the BBC arts department as the person who knew about film and had all of the relationships with the distributors. When the BBC film programme, Film 2010 at the time it would have been, when that was relaunched after Jonathan Ross left and rebranded, I was asked to go and be part of that team. So I did that for a year. And I have to say, I didn't enjoy that very much. I mean, there were elements of it that I really loved. I loved the people I worked with. You know, I loved the fact that I was making this film program, but it was live. Right. At like 11 o'clock at night. Okay. And often the way when you're working on a live, it takes a lot of production to make a live show work. I was finding I was getting more sort of caught up in the TV production side of things than the film side, yeah, of things. And so that was one of the reasons I then left the BBC to go and do this master's. So then I went to work for Indie, an indie production company, mm-hmm, who were producing the Mark Kermode's radio show. So I went to work on that for three years. Oh, okay. And I was producing all of their interviews, selecting the films for review and that kind of thing. So I did that 3 days a week. While I was doing my master's.
Okay.
Then I got to a point where I'd been doing that for 3 years, and I again sort of came to the same sort of realization that I'd come to previously, that was, I want to be, you know, my next obvious career step, if I stay doing what I'm doing, is I go and produce a bigger radio show, or I go and produce Gardener's Question Time or something like, yeah, that. And I wanted to do film. Also, I wanted to do something that really sort of challenged me intellectually. There was still this sense of, I think I want to write, I think I want to do something that's about my taste, my editorial instincts, about my, you know, about my opinions and what I think about things. And the only sort of model I had for that up until that point had been criticism.
Yeah.
It was to be a film critic or be a journalist. And when I was about to leave the BBC One programme, a job came up at BBC Films,
yeah,
to be their development assistant. And because the contract was coming to an end, I hadn't quite decided about the masters, so I applied for it,
yeah,
and had an interview and ended up not getting it. But through that process, I'd had an awareness of what BBC Films did. And BBC, yeah, Films are the feature filmmaking arm of the BBC, and one of the three main sources of public funding in the UK. So I had a sense of what that job was. And then, yeah, about 3 years later, when I was then thinking about what my next steps were going to be from the radio, that job came up again, and I applied for it again, and they said to me exactly the same things that they'd said before, but sort of more vehemently this time, in that, I think you're qualifying for, yeah, this job. Are you sure? Like, you're going to be really bored. Are you sure? Mm. And we kind of talked about it, and I ended up, you know, making a strategic move into that team, but taking a very big step down in terms of seniority, yeah, and responsibility from, you know, producing things for live broadcast and being the person on a very small production, mm, team that had all of the industry relationships, to then being at the bottom of a very strict hierarchy at BBC Films. Mm. And I then spent four years at BBC Films,
yeah,
the first as an assistant,
yeah,
and then I moved up to coordinator, and then I spent 2 years as a development executive there.
Right.
So in the end, it ended up being a really good strategic move.
Yeah.
Although at the time when I first took the job, the guy who hired me, Joe Oppenheimer, who's been a really great mentor to me and a very good friend, had said to me, you know, you're very unlikely to get promoted. Not because we don't think you're brilliant, but just, yeah, people don't leave.
Yeah.
They stay. You know, he'd been in that job a very long time. Everyone else had been in that job a very long time. So he was like, you know, come in, do the job for a year, learn how the industry works, make all the contacts you need to make, and then go. So that had been what I'd been intending to do, and I was just lucky. Someone ended up going on parental leave, and I got promoted, and there were some other sort of shifts in the team that meant, mm, I then was able to move up.
Yeah, I mean, so many questions come off the back of that. I mean, the first thing that springs to mind is, I hear that quite a lot, in that, especially with kind of circuitous routes to sort of the career that you want, in that you'll go for something and are told you're overqualified, and it's like, well, I might be overqualified in this kind of arena, but actually what I'm getting into, I I still have a lot of learning to do. How do you pitch yourself as, you know, the right person, even if you're presenting as, you know, you've got too many skills to bear?
I think it's a really tricky thing. I think the way I did it was, yes, I'm overqualified, but I really want this job, and I want this job because X, Y, and Z. And it's a strategic move for me. And I was quite sort of honest. I mean, at the time, I thought I wanted to be a producer, be an independent producer. I have to say, within a couple of months of being at BBC Films, I was quickly cured of that. I was like, I can't know. And I saw what the reality of being an independent producer is like. As I know, yes, not for me. But that's what I had genuinely thought I wanted to do. And so that is how I'd gone in and pitched myself. I was like, look, I know I'm overqualified, but I really want to learn, and I will do this for a year. And I think I was lucky. Joe and I got on really, really well. You know, I'd applied for the job 3 years before, so they knew I was sort of serious and keen. Mm. And Joe was also went above and beyond to teach me and to sit down and talk me through what a finance plan looked like, how production worked, to take me to set. Yeah. So I was incredibly lucky in that respect. But the one thing I would say about that is I spent so much energy trying to convince them to hire me, and probably not enough energy thinking about the reality of what taking such a big step down would do to my confidence and really? Sense of self. So that's something I would always tell someone to be mindful of.
Yeah.
Because although it absolutely did pay off, and I'm so grateful for that period of time that I spent there, and I learned so much. The first year was really tough, and to go from being someone who, you know, I'd spent sort of 6 years building relationships. I had a good reputation. I had a lot of autonomy, responsibility. I was working part-time and juggling my own stuff. And to go from that to then sorting out other people's diaries was a really, really, really difficult thing. And I found that a real struggle.
Yeah. Talk a bit about development and kind of what kind of the hierarchy looks like in terms of what were you doing as an assistant and then doing as a coordinator and then exec. How does that...
As the first thing to say is that titles are fairly meaningless. Titles mean different things in different places. So an exec at BBC Films or at the BFI is quite a different role to an exec at Blueprint, or again is different from an exec at a very small company. And just because someone has a certain title, you never quite know exactly what it is, what it is that they do.
Yeah.
But for somewhere like BBC Films, when I first joined, it was Christine Langan who was the head of BBC Films. Mm-hmm. Then there was Joe Oppenheimer who hired me, who was the commissioning executive. Then there was three development executives. Then there was quite a big drop, and then there was me. So I was the development assistant.
Okay.
So and actually, you know, if you do want to go into a career in development or into a career as being a producer, one of the best ways in is either to be a development assistant or to be a producer's assistant. So there were two of those sort of entry level roles at BBC Films. So I think the difference between me being a development assistant and a development coordinator is entirely semantics. I was doing exactly the same job, and it was just about me. I asked for a better title, and I kept asking for a better title. And honestly, I think that was... I don't know whether I would have been so pushy about it if I hadn't been feeling quite so bleak and low confidence about... I mean, I think often it's something you end up having to do is... you're very lucky if someone sort of taps you on the shoulder and says, you're doing a brilliant job, let me promote you, let me give you a better title, let me give you more money. And so often that's something you end up having to push for yourself. And I don't know if I would have done or been sort of confident or sort of bolshy enough if I just hadn't been feeling quite so awful about myself and it hadn't sort of felt like quite a sort of a necessity in terms of my sense of self. And then as I say, one of my colleagues went on, one of those development executives went on parental leave.
Yeah.
So I was promoted into that job.
Yeah.
And probably more quickly than anyone else would have been in my position, because although I there's no way I could have gone in at a higher level than the assistant role that I did. Yeah. Even though I had a lot of experience in other areas of the industry, development is a very specific thing. And, you know, I knew a lot about directors, a lot about critics, a lot about how, you know, the kind of films are consumed, how that cultural conversation happens. Mm. But I didn't know anything about writers, really. I didn't know how the relationships between production companies and agents worked. I didn't know how development worked on a sort of granular script level.
Yeah.
So there's no way I could have gone into at a high level. And there is no fast track to those senior roles. You just have to learn. And you have to build those relationships with agents. And you have to learn who the writers are. And you have to learn about sort of story structure and all of that sort of thing. But I think because I did have a certain confidence that came from having been in the industry for a certain amount of time, and because I had, from having worked with critics for a long time and having worked in already in a sort of in quite an editorial capacity around cinema, I had quite a good. I was able to express my opinions quite well. I was able to articulate myself, and I had quite a sort of well developed sense of my own taste, which is also one of the most valuable things you can have as a development person. And it's not something you can be taught.
Yeah.
It's you sort of, your taste is your taste. And I'm sure everyone would say they have brilliant taste, but it's about finding the people that have it's not necessarily about good or bad taste, although secretly I think of course it is. But it's about finding the people that have the same taste as you. If you are a development person whose taste is maybe suited to working at Element Pictures, it might not be as well suited to working at a different company. So it's about exactly. So it's about finding the right collaborators,
the people that
What
was your biggest learning from working at BBC Films?
You know, I got out of it what I went in trying to get out of it, which was I learned properly how the industry works at a very high level, and I learned how British cinema functions, you know, right from the development process to release. I learnt how the UK works, how it does co-productions, how it works with America. So that was incredibly valuable, and I think has put me in a very good position to do whatever else I do going forwards. Mm. Having that very, very concrete understanding of how everything works, of who everyone is, crucially. I think it taught me about writers. It taught me about UK talent. It taught me about new talent and the importance of new talent. It also taught me, this is sort of less in terms of like abstract knowledge, but in terms of you know, myself and my own career, it taught me to manage my career. Mm. Things like sort of fighting for a title rise or fighting for a pay rise. It also taught me, you know, perhaps the most valuable thing that anyone can learn is the art of the coffee, and how to email people out of the blue and say, oh, I just, you know, perhaps we could have a coffee, I'd love to pick your brain, which is a sort of mortifying thing to do.
Yeah.
The first few times you do it, your peers, even when you're assistant, will in 10 years' time be your peers when you're a development executive, or in 20 years' time when you're a producer. So those relationships are incredibly valuable. I learned how to network. It taught me to value my taste, taught me to value my editorial response to things. This is something I learnt. I mean, I learnt a lot from Joe. I learnt a lot from everyone that I worked with there, and I felt incredibly lucky to work with people who every single day made me smarter. But one of the things that I learnt specifically from Rose Garnett was to really to sort of value my taste and my response. And this sounds a bit, say, sort of speaking as a woman, but as a woman in male-dominated industry, and that was incredibly, incredibly valuable. And, you know, there's always that thing of, well, no one really knows anything, and sometimes it's just the loudest voice in the room. But being able to say with absolute confidence, I think this is really good, or, you know, I don't like this, and this is why.
Yeah.
Even if you are contradicting someone who is more senior than you, to be able to express yourself with real clarity and thought and care and smarts. That was incredibly, incredibly valuable. I learned sort of more both about the industry, but about myself, and you know, the kinds of jobs that I'm suited to and the kinds of jobs I'm not suited to and the ways I like to work and all of that sort of thing. I learned more about that in the 4 years there than I think I have at any other point.
Yeah, that completely rings true, just like having an opinion but also like knowing how to let it sort of like linger rather yeah. than like having to qualify it with, but you know, that's just my opinion.
Yeah,
or like
absolutely.
Being able to say it and expecting people to kind of disrespect it.
Absolutely.
Way.
No, that's a real, it's quite a big thing to learn, particularly as a young woman.
It's interesting because obviously you've now left development.
Yes.
Last year, I believe.
Yes, almost exactly yeah. a year ago, yeah.
And I think development's often, perhaps rightly so, put on a pedestal. It's a pretty peachy job in the film industry.
Yeah.
So it's often quite surprising when you hear someone steps away from that. Why did you make the decision to leave that sector and go into what you're doing now?
So I think, as I just alluded to, I learned a lot about myself when I was at BBC Films, and I'd always been in jobs, you know, working in live radio production or a weekly sort of magazine arts programme or on the London Film Festival that had been very fast-paced and that had quite tight deadlines, and you were always working towards something, and you produced a programme or you had some kind of tangible sense of achievement. And as you know, development is a very, very different sort of thing, and it's incredibly intellectually stimulating. And I loved working with, you know, some of the best writers and directors out there. And as I say, you know, some of the smartest colleagues in the industry. Mm. And being, you know, the privilege of being able to be part of those conversations at the highest level that are really setting the cultural agenda. You know, that's such an immense, immense privilege. But I did become aware that temperamentally and in terms of my personality, I'm better suited, and I get more satisfaction on a day-to-day basis when I have ownership over the job that I'm doing,
right.
When I am able to drive things forward, when I have deadlines and when I have that tangible sense of achievement. You know, I'm naturally more of a producer than I am a development executive. I do just also need to have that thing of I'm making stuff happen, and I get quite restless if I don't have that. So I was always slightly aware of that, and had felt like probably I at some point needed, which is why I'd initially thought I wanted to be a film producer,
yeah.
because I thought, well, I'd apply all that stuff that I learnt doing radio and TV production, and I'd combine it with my great passion, and of course I'd be a film producer, and that would be perfect. And then it turns out it was really hard. So that was one of the reasons. I'd also thought I'd been programming on the side.
Yeah.
You know, I'd been programming for the London Film Festival, running my own programming collective, and for a long time I'd felt like that was the place I wanted to go, was to do programming.
Yeah.
And I got to a point where, you know, development is a lifestyle job. You know, there's a lot of reading and watching,
yeah.
after hours. That is just part of your life. And then if you're trying to do other things as well,
mm.
that becomes quite all consuming. So I got to a point where I was like, I want to go and try and do things myself, and sort of expand on that programming, and see if I can sort of move a bit more towards the festival world, because by that point I'd sort of thought, actually, you know, the thing that seems to encapsulate the things that I'm best at, you know, making stuff happen with a curatorial sensibility, is festival programming.
Mm.
So it was an unusual thing to do, to walk away from that job.
Yeah.
I love Rose so unreservedly. I worked with her for 1 year, and that would have had such a huge impact on my professional life.
Mm.
But for me, I knew that I didn't want the next job above me. I didn't want to move into a commissioner role at this stage in my career. I was like, I want to explore those other avenues. And if I don't do it now, it'll probably be too late because I'll stay in this job. You get very comfortable. I'll get promoted.
Yeah.
It then becomes incredibly difficult to leave those jobs because you have the security and you have the salary. And I was at a point where, you know, I didn't have kids and I didn't have a mortgage. And I felt like I could take that risk and I could go and explore this thing that I felt like I wanted to follow, this passion I wanted to follow, knowing that, you know, if I went and tried it and, you know, it wasn't really what I wanted to do,
yeah.
I had these 4 years in development that I could come back to, you know, not walk back into BBC Films, but I had that experience that I could that I could then go and get another job in development.
Yeah, it wasn't like you're throwing that away.
No, not at all. But I did feel that I needed just to go out and see what the other options were. So I took quite a sort of brave leap and went.
Was it quite scary at that time?
It was momentarily, but also I knew it was absolutely what I needed to do, and so I also found it incredibly exciting. I then went to work at the British Council and I'm doing a job there where I work 2 days a week, and that was also sort of perfect because it's 2 days a week where I manage the programme of international festival selector screenings. So all of the key programmers from all of the big international festivals, so Sundance, Toronto, Cannes, Berlin, Rotterdam, etc., all come to London mm-hmm. at some point throughout the year, and they go to France and Germany and you know, India and elsewhere. But they will come to London, and I will show them 20 or 30 of the new British films that have been made over the past year for possible selection in their programmes. So that was really exciting for me in that it then sort of positioned me as part of that sort of festival world, but it was also making use of all of those relationships that I had with the production sector in the UK. I was still then part of, you know, speaking to BBC on a regular basis about their films. I talked to BFI, Film 4, but also sort of positioning me as someone in my own right rather than a sort of a cog in a bigger organisation.
And you making those curatorial decisions of, okay, these are the British films that are kind of in production, this is what I want to show them, how does that process work?
To a certain extent, it's really important that British Council is neutral
mm-hmm.
and that it supports all British films. So it's really important that I don't only show them the films that, you know, the BFI has backed, for example. So the way it works is that I do a call out. So, you know, at various times of the year, I will send an email out to got a big database of producers and sales agents and distributors and agents, and we'll say, you know, Sundance are going to be in town on such and such a dates. Please register your interest in screening for them.
Yeah.
And then everyone will register. Just because of the way, you know, the sort of the production calendar shakes out, it's pretty rare to ever have more than about 30 films registered to screen for a festival. Some of those bigger films that already have, you know, that are produced by a very well-established producer or a very well-established sales agent who have good relationships with that particular festival may already have been having those conversations for months, so don't need to screen through me because they've already shown the film in another way. So I will show everything that registers with me. But of course, my job is to provide programming advice. You know, I will have a good sense of, you know, a particular festival will be looking for a particular kind
yeah.
of film. You know, Tribeca will screen a very different sort of film to Rotterdam,
yeah.
which in turn will screen a different sort of film to Toronto. So my job is to have a very good sense of which films are the right fit for a particular programme. And of course, I will then still show them everything. But I will, you know, I will meet with festival programmers at various points in the year, you know, perhaps in Berlin or in Cannes or in Toronto. And I will say, you know, given that you have a a first and second feature competition, or given that you have your documentary strand, these are the films that you should be looking out for over the coming year. So yes, there's a certain amount of kind of soft touch curation, and you know, whilst I remain neutral and, you know, a sort of a good and vocal ambassador for all British cinema, it's also really important that those festival programmers trust my taste and trust my knowledge, and so that when I say to them, I really think you should look at this film, I know you haven't heard of it, I know it's got a really dodgy title, but I really think, you know, based on my knowledge of the UK production community, based on my taste, and based on my knowledge of your festival and what you're looking for, I think this is a really good fit. So it's about sort of managing that, about finding that balance.
That sounds amazing. I'm interested to know, when festivals are such a big part of your kind of working life, how, because obviously they're kind of all consuming, you spend up to, I don't know, 5 to maybe 9 days in one city watching loads of films, how do you prioritise self-care, how do you prioritise then socialising back at home, kind of what does that look like?
Such a good question. Yeah, so I probably go to, this year I'll have gone to Sundance, Berlin, Cannes, Carlo Vivari, Locarno, Toronto. I won't go to San Sebastian in the end, but in any other year, I might go to San Sebastian as well. So quite a few festivals.
Pretty much like one a month, isn't it?
Yeah. It is almost. So I'd say I don't tend to drink at festivals. Mm-hmm. Don't tend to go to parties at festivals. So it's really boring. I'm not, I promise, I'm really cool. But of course I go to parties that are part of my, when that's part of my job.
Yeah.
But I don't tend to like go out part like partying.
Yeah.
Because I just know, I'm old enough to know myself, and I know that I can't do my job tired and on a hangover. Yeah, I just can't. Yeah. And I can't, you know, when I was working at BBC Films, I would watch 6 films a day at a festival. You know, my job was talent tracking and to sort of be across everything. And I can't watch 6 films a day if I'm tired and if I'm hungover. And I can't have meetings with, you know, the one time you get to see your American partners. Yeah. You see them, yeah, once a year at Toronto. And you can't have a sensible meeting if you're exhausted and hungover. So of course I'll have like, you know, a glass of Prosecco or whatever at some drinks reception, but I just don't drink in general. Yeah. And I try and be in bed by midnight or so. Finding healthy food is really hard, particularly I was in Sundance the first year. And there's just nowhere to eat. It's really hard. So the thing that I do, so in if I'm staying in an apartment, like in Cannes or Sundance, I'll do a big supermarket shop and buy loads of like healthy snacks and things and loads of salads. And so, I'll live on those. And then I'm generally a real creature of habit. I know at each festival that I go to, like in Cannes, I'll know where that one bakery is that does the nice quiche. In Toronto, again, which is really hard, I'll know that, you know, I know where the Fresh and Wild is that I can go and buy a salad.
Yeah.
Or I know where the place is that'll serve me like a chai, like breakfast pudding, so that I'm not having to live off croissants every day. Yeah. But that is really hard. And I also have I'm an absolute skincare addict. So I've lots of like miniature things of all the things that I take because then I travel so much. So I take all of those. And my friends always laugh at me with how much like hair products and skincare stuff I take with me everywhere.
I had that recently where I was like trying to fit everything into those little like plastic bags and I couldn't fit it all in. And they're like, one bag only. And I'm like, like something's gonna have to go.
Yeah. But I've got it down to fine art. The thing that is hard though then is obviously exercising. There are people who are very good at taking their like running kits and, you know, running along the waterfront in Toronto in the morning or using the hotel gym. I've never been very good at that. Mm. So I do find that you can get into a good rhythm in London of like jogging or running or going to the gym for a couple of months, and then you go away for 10 days or a week. And it's slightly, and then it takes you a week to recover, and so then you have to start all over again. So that's quite tricky. And I'm still sort of figuring out quite what the balance is.
But also then in terms of professionally, so you do the British Council job 2 days a week.
Yeah.
Are you still doing acquisition consultancy?
I'm not actually at the moment. Okay. So one of the great things about the British Council job and one of the most attractive things about it was that it was part-time.
Yeah.
And it meant I could then do my own things. So I could do my own programming, and then I could also sort of dip my toe into various other, because you know the whole sort of project of leaving the BBC was a little bit of an experiment of just seeing what was out there. So I spent about 9 months doing acquisitions consulting for a sales company, for Film Constellation, which was brilliant. And I really loved putting the, it was a really nice balance to what I was doing with the British Council in terms of it meant I was still talking to producers and directors and still thinking about scripts and budgets and audiences and, you know, the marketplace and that sort of thing, as well as gaining a more commercial, a better understanding of the commercial space, which you end up being quite protected from when you're working for a public funder.
Yes.
Especially somewhere like the BBC, you have the immense privilege of being able to have, you know, potentially slightly woolly conversations like, does this deserve to be in the world? Is this something, you know, for the general kind of cultural good, rather than, yeah, but is someone, who's going to see it? And of course, that's something you think about as well. But, you know, when you work for a sales company, you really are thinking in very commercial terms. So that was incredibly valuable. But I did that for 9 months. And now I'm working alongside the British Council. I'm programming the industry strand for the London Film Festival, which is a five month contract. A lot of those festival jobs are short-term seasonal jobs.
Yeah. And they've had an industry programme before, but this is the first time they've had a specific programme before?
Yes. So, I mean, the LFF, first and foremost, is a public film festival. But over the past, I think it must be maybe about the last 10 years or so, gradually there's been an industry element. And it's been something that has been programmed by the rest of the programming team. But there's never been one single industry programmer who has had curatorial oversight of the whole strand. So it's a new job in that respect, and a new job in the team, as well as me being new to it.
It sounds like a really exciting opportunity in that it's a marriage of, as yeah, all the things you've sort of done. Really.
Absolutely, no, it's really exciting, and it's you know, it's one of those things that it's exactly the sort of thing that I left the BBC to be doing.
Yeah.
But of course, I didn't leave the BBC knowing that I would get this kind of job. You have to take a slight risk and a leap of faith. I love it, and I'm really pleased to be doing it. And the two jobs, the British Council and the LFF, complement each other really, really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, it's also absolutely a deadline-driven kind of make stuff happen kind of job, which at the moment is really exciting. Let's see how I feel come October. In case of careful what you wish for, but yeah, it's I'm very, very pleased to be doing it.
Can we touch upon that actually, in that you said like this is exactly the job that you left the BBC to be doing, but obviously there's been a year gap and that obviously hasn't been barren, but has that been easy or difficult transition, and thinking, you know, am I going to get something that makes it feel worthwhile?
I mean, I have to say, the British Council job, actually, as soon as I got that, I was like, I felt like this was the kind of job I left the BBC to be doing. Okay. So, you know, I mean, the LFF job is, in a sort of more abstract sense, it was the thing, that kind of thing is what I left the BBC for. But I felt like I was doing that from the moment I left.
Yeah.
You know, I had maybe a month or so, or a couple of months where it was the summer and I slightly took it a bit easy.
Mm.
And then I started working at the British Council in the autumn, you know, around Toronto time. So it was only a couple of months between the two. And really, I felt, you know, even if I hadn't been doing anything else with my time, I would have felt like I'd have absolutely struck gold with doing the British Council.
Mm.
So no, actually, at every single stage of the past year, I felt absolutely the right thing to. Of course, there are times when, you know, I'll go back and I'll see the team, because I see a lot of the BBC team. Yeah. We're all really close, and you know, both in a social sense, but also I have a lot of dealings with them professionally through the British Council. Mm. So of course there are times when you're like, oh, I miss you guys. You just miss brilliant people. And as I say, you know, I will always, you know, there's always a little part of me that wants to just be part of Rose's team, doing whatever she's, you know, just making her tea for the rest of my life. Perhaps for the first time ever, I feel like I don't necessarily have a clear sense of quite what the end goal is, quite where I'm, where, yeah, sort of what the final ambition is. I sort of feel very, very happy with just what I'm doing in here and now, and know that's taking me forward in the right sort of way.
On that note, like, something that I've come to the realisation of is that there's a lot of fixed-term contracts in this industry. Mm. And I find that quite difficult, in that you want to give it your all, because you're like, well, I'm here for 6 months, I might as well just go full steam. So A, you're more liable to burnout. But then also you've always got your kind of eye on the fact that it's ending soon, and you're kind of thinking, well, should I be like looking for the next thing?
Mm.
How do you balance those two things when you kind of know that, yeah, in October, this role won't be there anymore?
I think because when I first started out, I did a lot of fixed term contracts. They always just, something just always came up.
Mm.
I think I'm better suited to doing those freelance fixed term things than perhaps someone who had been at the BBC permanently for 9 years and then had left, and that could be a very scary thing. So I think it's really important just to sort of trust that something will come up, and if you the right sort of, I mean, finding a job is a job unto itself. So I, you know, I feel like, well, my job between now and October is this job.
Yeah.
And then from November onwards, my job is finding the next job.
Yeah.
But I have the British Council is a year-round permanent thing.
Yeah.
So I know I always have that anchor. Mm-hmm. And then I have that little flexibility, you know, so I'm not going to be destitute.
Yeah.
I can,
yeah,
pay, I'm my rent.
Yeah.
So, and that's a privileged position to be in.
Mm.
I mean, I have to say there was a point, you know, one kind of like dark moment at like 3 o'clock in the morning, just as I was leaving the BBC, where I was convinced I was going to have to go and move back to my mum's house, and I was going to, you know, live in her spare room, and I was, you know, never going to leave. Like, I was going to work in a coffee shop in Stroud. And I have to say that wasn't entirely unappealing. yeah, you know, things work out.
You do just, and as well, like, I always think that the opportunities, when they do come around, it's not something you could have predicted or...
Yeah.
Have bet upon, like,
yeah. I mean, that's
in 2 weeks you'll just see something that's perfect and it will have happened.
That's exactly the thing. You know, even though for a long time I'd felt like that was the place I wanted to be working,
mm.
I had no idea that the British Council job would come up. I don't want to say luck, because I am also a firm believer in creating your own luck and being sort of bold enough and putting yourself in situations where you are sort of open to possibility.
Mm.
But I am also aware that I have also been lucky.
What's the biggest myth around the film industry that you want to bust?
I suppose there's all the obvious things, like it's not as glamorous, it's really hard work. But I wonder if the sort of the big thing for me is really all about relationships. Everything comes down to relationships, and just being nice to everyone, being a good person to work with, is, I think, the most important thing. I mean, it's increasingly more common now, but certainly for the first 5 years or so of my career, I don't think I applied to a job advert.
Mm.
And that's because I spent a lot of time, I didn't enter the industry from a place of privilege. I didn't have family who did this sort of thing. I had no knowledge of how the industry worked at all. But I just met a lot of people, and I then was quite good at following that up with emails, and, you know, as I say, emailing the woman at the BBC, or when I finished that first year working on the London Film Festival, I emailed all of the distributors that I'd worked with, mm-hmm. saying, my contract's come to an end, I'm looking for a job,
yeah.
Which is then how I got the job at Revolver. I was asked to go back the next year on the London Film Festival, because I'd worked with them previously and we'd got on, and I'd been good. And then I'd been, you know, asked to go to the other, work on the other film program and work on the other film program, because I'd known people and I'd sort of got on well with people. And so I think that's the most important thing. I've never left a job on bad terms with anyone. And I think that's really, really important and really important to keep those relationships, because you never know when you will, you know, and not just in a sort of cynical, selfish way, but you never know when you cross paths with people. Yeah. So I think relationships are absolutely, absolutely key. One of the big things is, you know what, now it's very, very, very difficult to make a living out of writing about film. And that was one of the reasons I told myself I didn't end up going into film journalism. I think really probably it was that I was scared and I wasn't confident enough. But it was just at the period that the internet was, you know, there was Rotten Tomatoes and there was IndieWire.
Yeah, but also social media.
And maybe Delphi, but I think maybe Twitter had just started around that time. And there was certainly a sense of a shift and people starting to say, oh, it's quite hard to make a living, make money out of this. And I still see so many people coming into film going, I want to write about film. And the thing, you know, I think is those skills of being able to write, being able to you know, have a good critical judgment, being able to communicate that through writing, good knowledge of who all the directors are, who all the distributors are, how festival works. Of course, that's everything that you need to be a film critic or a film journalist, but that's also just the most basic stuff that you need to do nearly any other job in film.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I wish that I could explain to people that there are plenty of other jobs that you can do out there that will pay you a better wage, that will satisfy all of this stuff that you want to do. And actually, just writing about film now, I don't know that that's a sustainable way to live. It's increasingly difficult.
But it's like a handful, you know, maybe 10 people that you know, have the column for the big
sheet
or the big online, and everyone else that I know that does it freelance.
Absolutely.
And does it on the side of something else.
Yeah, you know, when a lot of the most well-established theatre critics are being cut, you know, from the Evening Standard, from the Guardian. I don't know how long before that sort of happens more in a more widespread way.
Mm. Yeah. Touching on relationships as well, like, I know that you have quite a lot of, like, friends in the industry, and I wonder, like, how important that is to you to sort of have that girl gang. Like, is that something that you really are fortunate to have?
It's so important to me. I have a brilliant WhatsApp group that I'm part of. You know, that's on a more sort of, you know, we're all quite, and that's all a group of women who work in film, and we're all quite good on quite a basic level of just going, yeah, you go, girl. But then I have a lot of different people that I go to. You know, a lot of my friends initially were sort of critics and programmers, so I have those friends. Then I have friends that I've made through development. It's sort of a mixture. There are my peers. Then there are people more senior to me that I would go to for career advice. So people like Rose Garnett, Joe Oppenheimer, Lizzie Franke, other people. And of course, you use those relationships, you know, strategic. You don't want to be calling them up all the time. These are busy people. But if I had a sort of, it was like, I'm wondering about whether this is the right career move, whether this feels like a good thing to do, those are the people I would go to. And then you have your, you know, you have your industry friends who you talk to about, you know, you meet to sort of talk about, oh, you know, who are the directors you're interested in? And, you know, they're people that I'll have a really nice coffee with and I'll see at film festivals. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, very good professional friendships. But I wouldn't call them up and tell them about, you know, my terrible anxieties about whatever, because there's still a certain amount of, you know, professionalism that you have to sort of keep. And then I have my friends, both inside the industry and out, that you can then feel like you can be far more vulnerable with.
Yeah.
And you can do that thing of like, oh God, you know, I go into work every day and pretend I know what I'm doing. But, oh my God, I really don't. Yeah. yeah, lots of different friendships that sort of serve different purposes, mm. and also, you know, friendships with people more junior who are, you know, I've really benefited from the sort of mentorship of people ahead of me and support, and that's something I feel it's really, really important to sort of pay back. So I have, you know, various people that I've worked with, mostly at BBC Films, who are sort of more, who I kind of, I suppose, had a sort of unofficial sort of mentorship relationship with there, and then see quite a lot of now.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, those sorts of relationships, those sorts of unofficial mentoring are really valuable. Mm.
But I see that as like exactly the way we should be going about things, to kind of open access. It's like paying it forward, you know?
Absolutely.
If you've had a good experience from someone showing you that kindness, like, it's only going to kind of continue. And I've always appreciated, you're so good on Twitter, like, retweeting like jobs that come up, and just like having that sense of like a trusted source that you can think, oh, well, they kind of know that,
yeah,
that might be a good role.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, it's funny, so part of that is obviously that you want to help people, mm. but also you want to have good people in good roles in the industry, and also just awareness of, you know, those jobs are really advertised. So it is that thing of, you know, retweeting someone who says, oh, we're looking for a development assistant or something. It also means I don't have to spend ages thinking about really smart things to say. I can just like retweet other retweet jobs.
And then kind of the end, what's a film that you've seen recently by a woman director that you think is an undervalued gem that you think more people should be checking out?
I think it's not necessarily an undervalued gem. Maybe it is. I mean, it's one of my absolute favourite films, so obviously I think everyone in the world should have seen it, but maybe they haven't. It's a film called Vendredi Soir by Claire Denis, and my friend Sophie Monks-Kaufman just programmed a season of Claire Denis films down at the BFI and showed the film as part of that. And it's a wonderful sort of exploration of female sensuality and desire. A woman who, you know, over the course of one night meets a stranger in a traffic jam, and they share a night together in a hotel before she goes back to her boyfriend, mm-hmm. the next day. Mm-hmm. And it's just really hot. Yeah, a really sensual and quite rare exploration of desire.
Mm.
So I'd highly recommend that. Obviously, the best way to see it is on a nice 35mm print at the BFI, but that's gone now.
Feeling
but
that, I'm hoping it comes up on Mubi, because they've currently got.
They have, yeah.
So I'm waiting for that. And then finally, is there a woman that you've worked with that you would like to spotlight because they're doing great work?
I'd just like to, you know, shout out to a couple of women that have really mentored and supported me, and I think are doing amazing work in championing and supporting other women in the industry. One, of course, Rose Garnett at the BBC, Evie Yates at the BBC, who is their new talent commissioning executive, is doing amazing work with supporting newer voices coming through in the industry. Lizzie Frankie does a lot of work in that space as well, and I think is an amazing champion of both women, you know, coming up through development and producing, as well as, of course, supporting writers and directors. Though those women have all been incredibly important in my life. And then also, you know, I should say, you know, my two current bosses, Tricia Tuttle at the BFI and Bryony Hanson at the British Council, are also brilliant and do a lot of great work of supporting and bringing through a new generation of, you know, men and women, but a new generation of talent in the industry.
Rowan, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, for me too. And we didn't even get to eat the posh chocolates.
No, well, we can eat them now.
Yeah.
Well, they're melted in hot room. Yeah.
Thank you so much to Rowan for coming on the podcast, and thank you for downloading and listening to the episode. You can listen to all 26 previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and Acast. Feel free to recommend them to a friend, write a glowing review, or get in touch to tell me who you might like to hear on season 2.